Azanya Mosaka on 702.
24 minutes to 3 o'clock. Now, throughout the show, I've been telling you about how we're concluding things today, which is to look at an interesting partnership that was announced by IBM. They announced the expansion of their quantum computing efforts to Africa in a new collaboration with the University of the Witwatersrand. And WITS is the first African partner on the IBM Q network, and it will be a gateway for academics across Africa and to the 15 universities who are actually part of the African Research Universities Alliance. And so you may be thinking, what? Quantum computing? I think it's safe to say that it's absolutely fascinating when you think of the power that we have in our pockets, because the equivalence that I've heard is that our smartphones have the computing power of a military computer from 50 years ago. Which was about the size of an entire room. And now we have that kind of power in the palm of our hands and it fits into our pockets. However, even with phenomenal strides that have been made in technology and classical computers since the onset of the computer revolution, there are lots of problems that classical computers just can't solve. Some have even equated them to being like a calculator on the inside. And so enter quantum computing, or quantum computers, that they are potentially the answer. They work in a different way. They have incredible memory. And this is the way forward, or the way of the future, many believe. And you have different quarters in the US and China and other countries that are technologically driven. They are that are in a race of sorts to figure out this problem of quantum computing and how it can be better stabilized and how it can be used more commonly, and over and above that, to come up with the fastest processing system. And there's been a race. I can't even keep. I think the last one was a Chinese computer. The US held the title for a short while. But now it's a Chinese computer that is believed to have some of the fastest processing power. So now we join Professor Zeblon Vilakazi. He is a WITS Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research and Postgraduate Affairs, and he's been greatly involved in this particular initiative. I'm hoping that he can explain quantum computing so that we can better understand how it will provide opportunities and solutions on this continent. Good afternoon, Professor. Thank you so much for your time today.
Good afternoon, Nadania, and good afternoon to the listeners.
I'm not even going to try. I'm not even going to try explaining what quantum computers are and the kind of principles and the mechanisms that are used for quantum computers. But is there a simple way of explaining it?
Yes. First, let me thank you for the very excellent summary. It actually captures the state of progress we have made as humanity over the last 50 years, as you mentioned, in terms of how much computing has changed our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Driven by what is known as Moore's Law, which stated that the amount of compute power will double every year, 2 years. And now this law is reaching what I would call its runway.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Therefore, you know, you need to think of other computing paradigms to actually ensure that you keep driving this track of human development, because what these devices do, whether we love it or not, they do change our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly for the better, but obviously, you know, can be for the worse as well. Access to news means that people do not have the appropriate means of screening the news, then you find yourself with fake news and so on and so forth. But by and large, the last 6 years have seen great strides in human progress in telemedicine, in being able to communicate with each other,
and
increase in our access to information. So I think to me, despite some of the setbacks, the last 6 years have been characterized by huge jumps by humanity.
Mm.
So, you know, you've actually captured that very beautifully.
Yes.
Let me if I may, just give you a few minutes on quantum computing, and I'll try to just explain to your listeners what quantum computer does.
Mm-hmm.
But if you allow me, can I just explain to you what we call a digital computer or a classical computer,
yes,
the one that you have in your smart device. Computing just works on a simple language. You and I communicate using what is called Latin alphabet, which go from what A to Z, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And nine and numbers. rather 10 if you include zero. So after this, we're able to write Shakespeare, you know, Cervantes, everything you know about modern history, the Bible, and others have been written using just 26 alphabets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it just depends on how you combine them and you string them into sentences and so on and so forth. Now, the computer does the same thing as well. Instead of using ones and twos and so on and so forth, it uses two numbers, zeros and ones.
Yes.
Right? These are called bits, binary integers.
Mm-hmm.
So after these bits, you are able to combine them into groups of eight, which are called bytes. Right?
Yeah.
And therefore, we can scale them into kilobytes, megabytes, which is what, like a million bytes, and so on and so forth. That is a vocabulary that you have to do everything a computer does, from doing highly complex calculations and to actually writing information that appears to you as normal English or Suzuki's course or whatever.
Yeah.
But deep inside the machine, you have a series of zeros and ones in this binary code that's called bits. I'm sure that's clear.
Yes, so that's clear.
So they're governed by switches called that go on and off, right? I can tell you now, with this matter, I'm using an iPhone, yeah?
Yeah.
I've got something like 100 billion small switches. As I'm telling you, keep on going on and off to make sure that you communicate.
Mm-hmm.
They are located in what is called an integrated circuit of a silicon microchip.
Mm.
That you've heard about, right?
Yes.
So therefore, that's a great advance to actually develop a transistor that is now concentrated into a million or billions of these transistors that are little switches that communicate with us, that allow us to communicate.
Yes.
That operate on this binary code. Simple. Mm-hmm. That's how a classical computer works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does a quantum computer do? Remember, I said you've got zero and one,
mm-hmm.
right? Zero and one, on and off. You group them. A quantum computer says, "Hell, you know, at a level of small devices, because the smaller the device become, you know, you start operating in a space where another physics of the small world takes place."
Yeah.
You and I live in the world where laws of gravity, Newton's laws apply. Mm. But you know that. I mean, if you drop something to go to the ground, an apple will fall from the tree and hit your head.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, if you go to the scale of electrons, right, protons, and the tiny particles,
yes.
they behave in a very strange way. Instead of being localized in one position, they're almost diffused like waves. And if you take one particle, it will interact with another particle almost like at an infinite distance apart.
Yes.
Those are called entanglements. It is one of the most challenging scientific problems that explains nature perfectly well at that scale, but has presented to humanity a very complex understanding of what is the real nature of reality.
Hmm.
So quantum computers now take advantage of that. That if I have something that I have a light that is on and off, I don't know whether it's on or off until I observe it myself.
Right.
Now, let's take a coin. Look at the coin, which is made of heads and tails, right? You can only have two sides of the coin,
yeah.
head or tail. That's your zero or one. Now, I take this coin, just do an imaginary experiment. Take a coin using your mind's eye and flick it in the air. For 2 or 3 seconds, the coin is turning. Does the coin give you heads and tails?
Phew, it's almost quite simultaneous.
Voila. And therefore, it's all simultaneous. So it's the head and tail at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That is the best example of quantum computing.
Wow. So at a subatomic level, this is computing at a subatomic level. And you mentioned that this is actually how nature works. These are insights from how nature even operates. I think that's fascinating that we are looking at the natural world to inform something like technology and computing. So is that where the lack of stability comes from then, or this question of needing to stabilize this, the question of how to stabilize it comes in?
That's correct. The most stable situation that you have in all of life is either a stable situation of zero or one, or heads or tails.
Yeah.
So something in between won't last for long, right?
Yes.
So you harness that short period to create an artificial state where your bits are now in the state of overlap between zero and one, which gives you infinite possibilities to just basically do all the computing within a period of time and get the answer quickly.
Right. So
in a small split second, you're able to get infinite possibilities, give you the right answer you want, and then get your answer in your normal state of stability.
Right.
So, researchers in Yorktown Heights in New York, where IBM is located, have got this quantum field device that has been cooled to temperatures of basically a few as cool as outer space.
Mm-hmm. All right, so there are problems that classical computers can't solve, but because of this insight and how these qubits, these quantum bits, can be used to harness better speed and better processing ability, we can have multiple problems complex issues being solved in a short space of time.
Absolutely. It gives almost near infinite, excuse the reservation here, it gives almost near infinite ability, right? Because it has infinite possibilities within a short period of time, of time to solve problems and then get your answer quickly.
Wow, that is fascinating. I think I get it. Thank you so much, Professor. Let's look at what this partnership actually means, as in physically and academically, what it actually means.
Obviously, I think the wrong decision because I've been involved in this. So obviously, I give you a very upbeat answer. But objectively speaking, Africa has missed out largely on the first, which was developed in the UK, the first industrial revolution of steam engines. The second industrial revolution came out because of electrification, right?
Mm.
And that gave us automation and so on and so forth. The third came out of the discovery of the silicon microchip transistor, which gave us the current smart devices, the digital age that we're talking about. Now we are on the verge of what others might call a fourth industrial revolution, right? Where we have an opportunity, you know, because of the nature of the world, now that the world is a bit more connected, we have an opportunity to participate. And I think to me, what this means for us and as South Africa is that now we are first movers. I think that those that actually reap the benefits of any scientific or industrial changes or technological changes are the first movers.
Mm-hmm.
So I cannot predict what's going to happen in 20 years' time, but all I can predict is if you look at the trends over the last 200 years of all these revolutions and technological disruptions, that those that were first movers, either by being early players, we could be the ones who will reap the greatest benefits.
Mm.
So we took the gap and took the opportunity to ensure that not only just that and the South African, but to connect it with other 15 universities in this research alliance that you spoke about.
Yes.
I think to me, it will actually ensure that we keep that little foothold with these developments. We don't have the machinery, the money to build a quantum computer, but you can join the network
right.
to ensure that you don't get left behind.
Yes.
So I'll leave it up to you and the listeners to, you know, make a determination whether is this a big deal or not.
So what kind of fields will be impacted? And what kind of research questions are you already putting forward as part of that can benefit from being in this network?
Right. Obviously, we need to address problems that, you know, are pressing to us as South Africans and Africans, right? And the big one is the burden of disease brought about by the HIV pandemic and the HIV strain in particular, which is a C-type C-type strain, more common within our region, okay?
Mm.
So if someone in the global north, in the United States, Europe, does HIV research, we'll focus on what is prevalent there to address their pressing problems.
Hmm.
At a practical level, to apart from, you know, drug design and understanding how the virus mutates. So here in South Africa, we have the C-type HIV strain, which has been understood clearly, but I think the problem is how do you respond to it?
Right.
At a level of ensuring that you fight it at a scientific, molecular, biological level, and also, of course, think of clever ways of getting appropriate drugs that we mitigate the impact of the spread in your body.
Mm.
So a group of researchers at Vets and other universities that are actually investigating that, and they were the first to say, well, actually, you know, a virus or a molecule, a protein molecule, also obeys laws of quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, the appropriate technology to do that is quantum computing, because we can solve these problems much quicker than a classical computer.
Yes.
And therefore, with this connection, so we are able to now get a team of researchers. They will learn. They take maybe 2 or 3 weeks to learn, you know, the kind of protocols to access the quantum keys, because they have to learn the language. In order to do that, they'll be able to now write code that will speak to that problem. I think to me that is the first of the many direct applications that will have a long-term impact on the continent. And the other one, of course, is our involvement in the Square Kilometer Array.
Yeah.
We will need to be among the first to use the data before we export the data to countries which are more resourced. And it's a South African investment. We don't want it to be, you know, the data to be used by other people.
Yes.
You can share it. But you must also be at the forefront of analyzing data.
Which is actually what I was going to ask you about, ensuring that this opportunity and the research that is happening is attributed, I don't want to say protected, because this is collaboration, it's important to collaborate, but that the recognition goes where it is deserved.
That's right. You know, I'm a firm believer that science knows no boundaries, right? An atom here behaves the same way as an atom in the nearest Andromeda galaxy. So science is boundless, not even bounded by any other geographical or political boundaries, but even it's universal. So I do believe in sharing of data. However, there must be appropriate recognition of those scientists that might not come from the world resource countries without the appropriate political power. So for them to be acknowledged, and I think in the past we've seen that a lot of these developments, although they are not, they happen to be on, you know, on the African continent, but the lead scientists will either be based at, you know, Harvard, MIT, or Oxbridge, or Oxford, Cambridge. So therefore, you know, we need our scientists to actually be what you call first authors on the articles.
Wow. So are there other technologies then that make up the quantum computing system? Because we have developments in other areas that are quite encouraging. It's great that it can be used to solve from the biological to the scientific to the astrological, that its scope is so wide. But what are some of the other technologies that make up quantum computing systems?
Yes, yeah, I might slightly you a little bit and I'll give you an answer. Something that affects all of us is the issue of encryption, right? When you log into a Facebook account or you log into your bank account, you usually type that unique identifier, that is your, you know, password that you and only yourself know. Right? Or you can share with people that you are. And that is encrypted. That's only unique to you, right? I did mention, though, that there are how many numbers? There are about 9 numbers, right?
Yeah.
Or 10, rather, if you include 0. And you've actually multiplied them into billions and billions of numbers that give you countless encryption codes. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So now, a professor at MIT in 1994, Professor Peter Shaw, said that an excellent quantum computer would be able to override all those encryption codes that, you know, have been used for, you know, NASA and everything in your bank account.
Yeah.
So of course, the curiosity, but however, some of the scientists realized that that's what, in a way, was one of the early triggers of this race for, you know,
quantum.
The foolproof quantum queue. Because the foolproof quantum queue now has been thoroughly studied and has given us what are called quantum keys that we are able to give you protection, even when the quantum computers become much more widely used into the day-to-day time. So therefore, out of that original concern, there was mitigation of it. So it did frighten me, but at the same time, I said, we don't have to worry about it, because now scientists and mathematicians have actually tried to override that problem by writing what are called quantum key systems that actually protect the data that would have been had by others. So, and that quantum key are done almost at the level of using our own classical computers. So therefore, we've been able to prevent people having access to quantum keys. However, it doesn't prevent a very bright 13-year-old hacker sitting somewhere in, you know, in a village in the city, Silicon Valley, Stanford, or Moscow, to crack us. I mean, some bright kid can just hack it.
Yes,
but that's very unlikely. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to ask you a philosophical question, because often with technology, we have these unintended consequences. I think artificial intelligence is fantastic. Algorithms are fantastic and so on. But they also present other risks. You know, there are threats or worries about unemployment and so on with artificial intelligence and the digitization of all sorts of spaces. We're talking big data, data analytics and so on. So the human being and some of the roles that we have seen might no longer be necessary. Some jobs will disappear. And also just the amount of information that we have at our fingertips. What could be some of the downfalls to quantum computing to society, because these consequences have caught us unprepared often, and regulation and policies have had to catch up to what technology has already run off and done?
Okay, a good one on that one is that it's a practical question, which obviously a lot of policymakers are thinking about. Automation, we mean that we have given some of the routine jobs to robots. Even some of the routine calculational jobs will be given, will be done by computers. Pascal has done a lot of this. Pascal application has been got a lot of bookkeeping nowadays, right?
Yeah. So
that computers actually and machines are much faster than we are. So the World Economic Forum did a study, I think late last year, early this year, which showed largely using what are called the OECD countries, the economically developed countries. They showed that about, my numbers are not correct, but about 70 million jobs will be destroyed. Right? So 70 million jobs that we currently take for granted will be gone in the next 30 years. Okay? Which is a problem. However, 130 or so million new ones will be created. So, you know, the glass is either half full or half empty.
Right.
There will be more new opportunities that will open up than the current opportunities that we have.
Okay.
And to me, the way we as South Africa, of course, with a high unemployment rate and the relative levels of skills, is to leapfrog, is to jump. Instead of going from A to B and C, we must go from A to C directly.
Okay.
And that is through, and I think I'm not an educationalist, a policy maker, I'm a research scientist, and a philosopher. Is lifelong learning. I think we must always keep on reinventing ourselves.
Right.
And third, is that certain areas that actually we're taking as soft sciences or soft skills are becoming more needed.
Yes.
You know, conflict resolution, collaboration, psychology in the age of digital.
So we mustn't fear. I think we've lost the professor. The line's just gone quiet while he was speaking. Oh, what a pity. But in fact, we are out of time. That was Professor Zeblon Vilakazi, WITS Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research and Postgraduate Affairs. I hope you got that. I think I got it. I didn't need the help of the Holy Herb or anything like that to get a complex concept such as quantum computing. Wow. So that's the way of the future, especially after this partnership. And let's see what kind of research questions they will attempt to resolve through this partnership and being part of this network to solve Africa's problems. And of course, humanity's problems, because we always have to think with the most vulnerable in mind, not with the most privileged in mind.